Merck & Co. v. Vincent, Thomas G. Bell, Appellant's Counsel, Stephen F. Forbes, Appellee's Counsel.
Has left the conference.
All right. It looks like counsel is present. Mr. T. Bell, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Tom Bell, and I represent Merck & Company, the employer in this workers' compensation case. Their employee, the claimant, Merrick Vincent, is claiming permanent total or lifetime disability benefits, and the issue in this case is whether he is entitled to them under the statute. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if that's allowed.
All right.
The facts of this case are not in dispute. In February 2009, Mr. Vincent was lifting a briefcase out of the back of his car, and he injured his neck and his left arm. The case was found to be compensable. He had neck surgery, and a year later, after his surgery, he was at home and testified that he became dizzy from some medication that he was taking, fell down the stairs, and hurt his left knee. Under the recognized compensable consequences doctrine that we'll discuss in more detail, that made it a compensable accident. He has received his full 500 weeks of benefits, and we recognize that if he were otherwise qualified, the injuries to his left arm and his left leg would be sufficient to qualify him under the statute. The issue in this case is a simple and straightforward one, and it's whether the two injuries, the one to his left arm and the one to his left leg, occurred in the same accident as the statute required. As we all know, workers' compensation benefits are governed by statute, and the statutes involved here are first, section 65.2-500, which allows temporary total weekly disability benefit for a disabled employee. That is also governed, though, by section 65.2-518, which says that the total compensation payable under the Workers' Compensation Act shall in no case be greater than 500 weeks. There are three exceptions for that. Two of them deal with coal miners' disease, not in here. And the third, which is involved, says except in cases of permanent and total incapacity as defined in section 65.2-503C. Section 65.2-500D provides that if a claimant qualifies under section 65.2-503C, he can get benefits for his lifetime over and above the 500 weeks, and that's what's being claimed here. Section 65.2-503C, as applicable here, allows those benefits when there is a loss of hands, arms, legs, eyes, or any two thereof. And the language which is in question here, it requires that it be in the same act. The only route to lifetime benefits available to this claimant is under 65.2-503, and it requires that the two limbs have been injured in the same accident. The inquiry then becomes, with the arm and the leg injured in the same accident, and the clear answer is no. In 1977, this court decided the case of Leonard v. Arnold, and the facts in that case are indistinguishable. The claimant hurt his heel on the job, was awarded disability benefits, and a week or so later, while in a restaurant eating lunch, he was on crutches, and the crutches got caught in the stairs. He fell and injured his back and neck. The second injury was compensable, again, as a compensable consequence, because the crutches from his original injury or what caused it. It was tied to his employment even though it was off the job. The issue in Leonard or Arnold was whether there was one accident or two. The doctrine of compensable consequences that we cite often but rarely discuss in detail covers two situations. The first is where there is natural progression or deterioration from the original injury. In these cases, that normally applies when somebody, say, breaks a leg, and because the person is limping, they then get an injury, they then have problems with the other leg. That is considered a change in condition, and it all comes from one accident. But when there, as in this case, and as in Leonard against Arnold, there's a new accident caused in some way by the treatment from the first accident, That is not the case. It is not a change in condition and not a natural progression. As the court said in Leonard v. Arnold, when a primary injury is shown to have arisen out of the course of employment, every natural consequence that flows from it is compensable. But this rule, which was strongly relied upon in the Industrial Commission's opinion, has no application to a new and separate injury. That would be what applies here. In that case, they found that the second injury sustained by Mr. Arnold was the result of a new and separate accident, not a change in condition. If the crutches fall as a new and separate accident, then the medication-induced fall in our case is too. And from there, the analysis is simple. The fall down the steps was a new and separate accident. Section 65.2-503C is the only provision for lifetime benefits and requires the injuries to be in the same accident. A new and separate accident simply cannot be the same accident. The Court of Appeals relied largely on Section 65.2-507, which is not one of the accepted things. But it also found that Section 65.2-503C applied and said, under the compensable consequence doctrine, all compensable consequence injuries are deemed to have arisen out of the original accident. There is no authority for that statement. The compensable consequence doctrine, when it has to do with a second accident caused by treatment from the first, says that even though in this case it happened at home when he hadn't done any work for the employer for more than a year, it's considered arising out of and in the course of employment. That's not the issue. The case law clearly says it's deemed to have arisen out of employment, but nowhere does it say that it is part of the same accident. The Court of Appeals made that statement, but there is no authority to support it, and in fact the authority is to the contrary. The finding by the Court of Appeals flies in the face of Leonard and has no application in this case. The Court of Appeals also relied on Section 65.2-507, though the claim in this case was only filed under what we discussed, 503C. The obvious answer to any application of Section 65.2-507 is that it is not one of the accepted statutes, one of the exceptions to the general rule for 500 weeks in Section 65.2-518. So since it is not, the limit is 500 weeks and 65.2-507 simply can't apply. The court, though, found somehow the removal of language from the predecessor statute of 507, talking about 500 weeks, means that it's unlimited. But Section 65.2-518 contradicts that. Also, the Court of Appeals relied on the 1945 case of Morris v. Pulaski Veneer, but that case is not applicable either. In that case, the claimant had had two injuries 10 years apart, one to each hand. He filed for permanent total disability benefits under the statute as it was in 1945. And the court awarded, but it said that Section 32 of the Act applied to two injuries in the same accident, and said that did not apply. The Morris Pulaski Veneer did not qualify as in the same accident, but it found another statute which allowed in a second injury in those days permanent total disability benefits. That is gone from the statute. It is no longer part of the statute. But somehow the Court of Appeals said it was still there in some language about extending time. That language makes no sense and has no authority to support it.
Mr. Bell?
Yes.
Mr. Bell, this is Justice Goodwin. Explain that again as to how you distinguish Morris.
In Morris, there was, in those days, the statute that what's now Section 65.2-503C, talking about in the same accident. There was also it was Section 36 then. It's the predecessor basically to 507, and there it said in those days it had a specific provision that said if there were two accidents in the same employment, then the claimant qualified for permanent total disability benefits. But that language is no longer in the statute, so it doesn't apply that two accidents in the same employment would qualify for permanent total.
What language is no longer there?
The language that said, and I can find it for you, that the same accident statute was not exclusive. You had to look elsewhere, and they looked at what was then called Section 36 of the
Act. Can I stop you right there?
Yes, ma'am.
Can I stop you right there? Because they said the conditional enunciation is not intended to be exclusive, but that was something that the court said. That wasn't part of the statute. That was the ruling of the court.
The court said that in those days there were two statutes that required, that allowed permanent total disability. One was the one we have now. The other was that statute, which is no longer there. That language has been taken out of the statute, so you cannot any longer, I think it's without argument, that you can't get permanent total disability for two successive accidents in the same employment. That was the law in 1985, but it's not now. Yes.
Mr. Bell, this is Justice Mims. I agree with you that Section 36 simply no longer exists. Can you also speak to the relationship between the former Section 36 that is no longer there and the current Section 65.2-518? Are they consistent, or has 518 countermanded the former 36?
I think it has countermanded this former 36 because they took out the provision in the former 36 that allowed permanent total disability benefits for two successive accidents. That's not in the statute anymore. And they enacted Section 518, which says you only get 500 weeks unless you meet Section 65.2-503C for the same accident, and this simply doesn't.
Well, what about the compensable consequences doctrine? Isn't that part of what has supplanted it? So that in this case, you have two incidents. One was clearly on the job. The other was not on the job, but was a result of taking medicine, pain medicine, for an injury that occurred on the job. So what is the compensable circumstances doctrine, and what role does it play anymore? Or now?
The compensable consequences doctrine is very much alive, and it applies to two situations. One is a change in condition, a natural progression. That is all from the first accident. It also, if there is a separate accident, and this is all set out in that Leonard case, if there is a separate, new and separate accident, it ties it to the employment, but it is a separate accident and not the same accident.
All right. Well, you wanted to save some time. You've got 2 minutes and 8 seconds left.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Chief. I've got another question for Mr. Bell.
All right. We'll eat up all his time.
Just a good one. I'm sorry, Mr. Bell, to eat up your time.
That's okay.
But the question I have is the statement you made about the language in the Morris case where it says the conditional enunciation is not intended to be exclusive. They were not quoting the statute. That was a ruling of the court. The language was not in the statute to say that.
But the court then said it must be read with the other appropriate sections and all be given the composite related meaning. And then it went on to award the benefits under Section 36 as it existed then. But that's not how it exists today. The language that court relied on has been removed from the statute and doesn't apply in this case.
But it seems like to me Section 36 and Section 507 have very, very similar language.
There's a lot of similar language, but the one thing that's been taken out of it is the right under what was then Section 36 to permanent total disability. Now the statute says you only get it under 503C, and I think under the Morris case, they make it clear that wouldn't cut it.
And my only quibble is I don't believe that language was in the statute before. But we had a holding which put that language in the statute that imputed that language to the statute. So I don't think that language was in 36 in the beginning. But save the rest of your time. I'm done, and you can think about that while you have your time, while you wait.
44 seconds. All right. Mr. Forbes, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Judge. Thank you, Justices, for the opportunity to speak to you today. I have had the pleasure of representing Merrick Brad. We know him as Brad Vincent for the past 10-plus years. Merck, a pharmaceutical company, is responsible to its employee, Merrick Brad Vincent, for indemnity benefits for permanent total disability for injuries suffered in an industrial accident dating back to February 10th of 2009. Merck engaged Mr. Vincent as a pharmaceutical rep. At the time of the injury, Mr. Vincent was 41 years old, married, one child at age two, and one on the way. The initial injury occurred.
Counsel.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Since both parties agree on every single fact, I'd like to actually move beyond the facts with the limited time that we've got, if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
Okay. Did your claim name 65.2-507? Is that the basis of your claim?
No, sir.
Okay. So 65.2507 has no relevance to this case. Is that correct?
It's not the basis for our claim. I would not begin to assume it does or doesn't have any relevance to the claim whatsoever.
Well, as the claimant who did not indicate that you were relying upon 507, what relevance would it have?
I would suggest that the statute we're relying on is in fact 503C.
Okay. And your argument is that the subsequent injury and the prior injury essentially become the same injury for purposes of 503C.
Yes, sir. That's exactly right.
So I do understand that argument, and obviously it's a colorable argument because it's one that was accepted by the Court of Appeals. I've come to a logical hurdle here, though, and that is that if, in fact, that argument is correct, then our holdings in Paul John Plastering and Amoco Foam must be incorrect. Are you? How do we square the holding in this case with those two holdings?
Deputy Commissioner, I'm not particularly well prepared to reconcile those cases. My purpose here today is primarily to try to focus on the arguments that defense counsel has made with respect to what I deem to be a statute of limitations case, the Leonard versus Arnold case,
I'm not asking about Leonard right now. I may ask about Leonard later. You are a very capable attorney, and I understand that your job is to represent your client, and you have done so very capably. Our job is to make sure that there's consistency with all of our precedents. And so let me go ahead and spend a little bit of time on Amoco Foam and Paul John Plastering. Here we have injury number one, and we have injury number two that relates back to injury number one. And your argument, which was accepted by the Court of Appeals, is that they are the same injury. If, in fact, injury number one and injury number two are the same injury, then if there is a third injury, like there have been in some of our precedents, then that would also be part of that same injury. They would all be in the same ball of wax, so to speak. But that's not what we have held before. If injury number three relates to injury number two, but not to injury number one, then it's not compensable.
I agree.
And those decisions cannot square with what's before us now, with your argument. And that's why I want to know how do you do that?
I think they do square. Now that I understand, I think I better understand the position that you've taken. We have two different injuries. The second injury, and only two injuries here, the second injury relates back to the initial industrial accident as a result of the doctrine of compensable consequence because there's a sufficient nexus between the two injuries. It's not a question of whether you have two accidents or not. It's a question of whether you have a separate injury to a second body part or to a second member as a practical matter. That's what relates back. So the original accident and the injury that comes from that accident creates the foundation or the predicate for the nexus that takes you to this case, which separates it from your premise that you were enunciating earlier, and I apologize, I was not following your line of thinking at that point in time. This is nothing more than an extension of the doctrine of compensable consequences.
My confusion is that I certainly understand, and we all accept the doctrine of compensable consequences. This is, in fact, an extension of that doctrine, and it is inconsistent with two of our precedents.
Well, respectfully, sir, I disagree that it's inconsistent with your precedents as a practical matter.
Okay, you may proceed.
Moving forward, in light of the fact, and as was just stated, Merck concedes that the 55% disability of the left upper extremity and the 50% disability of the left lower extremity render Mr. Vincent permanently totally disabled. Mr. Vincent has reached maximum medical improvement. Attorney Bell, on behalf of Merck, concedes Mr. Vincent is incapable of using his left upper extremity and his left lower extremity in gainful employment in a 40-hour work week without special accommodations. As has been stated several times already, none of that's in dispute. Mr. Vincent's injuries are deemed a result of the 210 of 19 industrial accident. Procedurally, two different statute of limitations are applicable to the filing of claims for injuries which occur after, but as a result of, the original industrial accident. Subsequent injuries caused by the original industrial accident, which generally take the form of progression, deterioration, aggravation of the original injury, are governed by 65.2708. For example, Mr. Vincent's low back injury, he also has a low back injury attenuated to this case, was likely governed by 65.2708. Subsequent injuries caused by the original industrial accident, but which would also involve a new accident, are governed by 65.2601. That is the holding in Leonard versus Arnold. For example, Mr. Vincent's knee injury is deemed to have occurred as a result of his original industrial accident, but the fall at home also constituted a new accident. Injuries as a result of a second accident are governed by 65.2601. That's in order to allow an employer an opportunity to investigate, as noted by Judge Huff in the Court of Appeals opinion. So how do we know that the holding in Leonard versus Arnold deals specifically with and only with the issue of determining the appropriate of the statute of limitations? The court said so. Citing Leonard, this court said the issue presented in the instant case is not whether the injuries suffered by Arnold or on June the 11th are compensable. The issue is whether an employee who suffers a new and separate injury, not a change of condition, arising out of the first injury, is required to give notice to his employer, his agent or representative, and to file an application for compensation with the Industrial Commission within the time limitations prescribed by 65.185 and 87, which were in effect at the time. How do we know this court also made clear the doctrine of compensable consequences covers new injuries suffered as a result of an industrial accident? Again, this court said so. It said so in the Emmer case. The insurer concedes. In Arnold, it says the insurer concedes Arnold's injuries sustained on June the 11th were compensable under the doctrine of compensable consequences because he suffered a fall caused by crutches required for treatment for the first injury. So citing Emmer, this doctrine extends the canopy of Workman's Compensation Act to the resulting injury. The doctrine extends the canopy of the Workman's Compensation Act to the resulting injury. Last time I checked, the synonym for canopy was cover. The doctrine extends the full cover, the full protection of the Workman's Compensation Act, not partial protection, to the resulting injury. So, with all due respect, I don't see this as an extension of existing case law. This
well,
is
counsel,
so because
counsel,
second
counsel,
injury.
Counsel.
Yeah.
I first of all, you said it was an extension, which is why that line of questions began. But let me actually ask this. Without the compensable consequences doctrine, an injury that occurred months later at home would not be covered by the statute, correct?
No question.
Okay. With that doctrine, It, in fact, comes within the canopy. It is
correct.
Now covered. It's covered. It is covered as if it were on the job for all purposes. The only issue before us is, does the statute require that it be, quote, the same injury to give you permanent total disability, or is it, in fact, two injuries statutorily, both covered, so that you get two partial permanent disabilities? Am I correct that that's the only issue that's in front of us?
That is correct.
Okay.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this question, if I might. As a result of Justice Mims's questions, am I correct that you disagree with prior decisions in Amoco and Paul John Plasterings? That seems to be your only answer. Are you suggesting that we should, in this particular case, overrule our decisions in those cases?
No, Chief Justice. I see it as being distinguishable from those cases, if I'm understanding. And again, I did not come here as candidly as prepared as I probably should have been with respect to understanding the full effect of those two cases. But based on the dialogue we've had thus far, I see this situation as being distinguishable, is what I'm saying.
What do you mean by you see the situation as indistinguishable? If it's indistinguishable, how can we hold for you?
No, if I said indistinguishable, my apologies. I meant to say distinguishable from those holdings. The point I'm trying to make here is that when cases say that because in a compensable consequence circumstance, because the second injury is deemed to have arisen out of the employee's employment, it's in the course of and arisen out of the employee's employment, that can't happen if you don't have the original industrial accident as set out in 65.2-503. So I think all of the compensable consequence cases, irrespective of whether they're based on a change in circumstance or whether it's a new accident, all are deemed to arise out of the original employment because and only because of the original industrial accident. That's what I'm saying.
Counsel, this is Justice Goodwin. I don't think anybody disputes that it arises out of the employment. The question is whether or not there's more than one accident. And don't we have precedent that clearly says that compensable consequence can be the result of a separate accident?
I agree. And I think the fact that the second accident, Justice, is to indicate that there are two accidents involved, but because of the compensable consequence doctrine, it's the statute, given the beneficial effect of the statute, the purpose of the statute, given that beneficial effect, given things like the two causes rule. The two causes rule, I think, is indirectly applicable here.
Let me stop you for a second, counsel, because given the language of the statute, which says that in order for there to be permanent partial disability, the injuries have to occur in the same accident, how do you get around that?
I think you've got two accidents, but for purposes of the statute, it certainly can be deemed to relate back to the original industrial accident. You've got two accidents, in effect, causing this second injury.
Okay, but once you say two accidents, you lose, because the statute says it has to be one accident that causes both injuries.
I'm suggesting the original industrial accident contributes to the injury to the extent for which, under the beneficial purposes of the act, it's deemed to have arisen. It's far less of a leap of faith from a interpretation perspective than was, for example, the Morris case. And to comment on that ever so quickly, my whole point in directing you to Morris is, if two accidents with the same employer can be deemed sufficient for permanent total disability, then certainly a case for which a compensable consequence, whether it be as a result of a new accident or whether it be as a result of a change of condition, can be deemed to be a basis for
counsel. Counsel, I wasn't going to return to the Morris case here, but do we agree that there was no common law of workers' comp?
Yes.
It's entirely a creature of statute.
Yes, sir.
Just give us the number. Where today is the statute that the court relied upon in Morris? What's the current number of the subsection 36?
Judge, it's the subsections that have been recited earlier, and it has indeed been taken away. It's 507, if memory serves me. And
you don't rely upon you don't rely upon 507.
No, I don't. No, I'm only arguing Morris for purposes of analogy, as I indicated earlier.
Okay. My question's answered.
And the statute was changed because at the time of the Morris case, there was
no permanent stay of 500 weeks. If Justice Mims' question has been answered, your time has expired.
Yes.
So, Mr. Bell, you have 44 seconds left.
To respond to what Justice Goodwin said, if you'll look at 183 Virginia on page 752.
Mr. Bell, yes. If they're not relying upon 65.2507, you don't have to answer my question.
Thank you.
But Mr. Bell, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Is the Court of Appeals holding consistent with our decisions in Amoco Foam and Paul John Plastering?
I don't think so, because I think you're talking about separate accidents. Nobody cited those cases, and I'd be glad to look at them, but...
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, counsel, your time has expired as well. The court will adjourn until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and the justices will reconvene in the justices' conference room. We are adjourned.